Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
That's not supposed to be that, okay? Just for the record. That is supposed to be, give me one second. Never mind. I can't play it. So hold on. Let me just play something else. All right. Since it is summer, that's Frank Sinatra singing "The Summer Wind." Joining me is a man who's made a little bit of his own news, Grant Newsham. Grant, what's going on? How are you?
Fine, thanks. I felt the reveille was actually pretty good. I appreciated that.
Well, since you're just starting to go to bed, I thought it was appropriate. Breaking news from the Associated Press. Lebanon's cabinet has resigned over the explosion last week in Beirut, which killed over 160 people, wounded about 6,000, the country's health minister says. What do you make of that? Why would the whole cabinet resign?
Oh, boy. Probably because it's Lebanon.
You know what? That's probably as good of an answer as you're going to get, right? Why not? I mean, the whole country's in disarray. Do I want to be standing here holding the bag for this shit?
It's really, probably for both of us. I think since about 1974 or five, Lebanon has almost been synonymous with like hellhole, and it had a little break in between there. But by and large, you hear the word Lebanon and Beirut in particular, this explosion didn't really surprise me. And so it's just sort of what they do. When they ever do get to the cause of this, I think it is going to be pretty interesting. I don't quite think it was fireworks that set off this big load of ammonium nitrate or whatever it was.
Oh, so you're chartering the black helicopter this morning?
Not in a black helicopter, but anywhere Hezbollah and the Iranians are, stuff seems to happen.
These accidents seem to happen?
Of course it is possible that it was, the cow kicked over the lantern and the fire led to this. But you always wonder, it could happen, because there's been other explosions in relatively recent history that have led to these sorts of things, similar ones. But there's just something about this that doesn't, I tend to associate it with Iran, Hezbollah, in some way would be my guess. But in terms of the cabinet resigning, even if this hadn't blown up, I think they'd have might have done it anyway, given what's happened to the economy and the financial system there. Financially, it seems to almost have hit like Venezuela sort of levels.
Why would you want to be in the Beirut cabinet? I mean, there's certain elements that lend itself, right, that lends certain countries to be in absolute disasters, right? And Lebanon has this confluence of Christians, right? Hezbollah, the Iranian influence there now, and where there is, no peace in sight. And why would you even want to be part of that cabinet? I mean, it seems like all you do is put yourself in a position to get whacked.
Something about these kind of countries that you notice is that we look at them from a perspective and from a distance, and a lot of what we can be a tendency to sort of base your opinion on the headlines or on some event or events in Lebanon's case, and to get the impression that it is such a sort of hellhole that nobody could possibly live there, nobody would possibly want to. But when you step back a bit or dig a little closer, I suppose, you can actually have a kind of normal life in those places. And if it's where you're from, you know, where your family's from, where your house, where everything is, that it is surprising just how much of a normal life goes on there. I was on a call a couple of months ago, and there are a number of people on. One of them was actually a woman from Lebanon, a professor, and she was up in the Lebanese mountains hiking. You know, this was just a couple months ago. And my point is that there is a certain normalcy that we may not be so happy about, but for the locals, it's how it is. And to be in a cabinet in those kind of countries, there's people who that's what they do. It's the guy who wanted to be student body president in high school or serve on the student council. You know, you can always find people to.
Well, wait a minute. I was on the student council at Christian Brothers High School. So you might want to rein that shit in. Okay. So, but even they say, hey, Mac, we want you to serve on the Beirut cabinet. I'd be like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. That might get you dead. And I don't want to be dead.
Yeah. You do wonder, but I think you'd be the Minister of Interior anyway, or Minister of Communications.
There you go. And that Minister of – nobody ever whacks a Minister of Communications, right?
Unless – not usually, I guess.
Thank you.
I think you see the point. I would note that most people on the cabinets don't get killed, but things have gotten to a point in Lebanon that
yes,
I suspect it's gotten dicier than it was at Christian Brothers High School. But they it's surprising just how much life does kind of go on. And people, you know, I've heard a number of people even, you know, in reasonably recent times say, you know, it's actually very nice here. You know, we like it here. But
you meet people that are from there, they just talk about how absolutely beautiful it was, and it was a place where, you know, people mm-hmm. got along, and then came, the 70s? Then mm-hmm. Beirut has since then essentially been a war zone, and now this. So you would be inclined to see, this is me, the optimist, but, it's perfectly plausible that thing just, you know, the cow kicked over. His reference to the cow kicking over the lantern is the Chicago Fire. For those of you that are rubes out there and don't know your urban legend, don't know your urban legends well enough. So I thought I'd enlighten you. But yeah, you know, in that part of the world, if you believe in coincidences, I've got some swampland I want to sell you, because that's not really how that shit happens.
Yeah, but your point about Beirut, the cliche that, you know, we all know is it used to be called the Paris of the Mediterranean or something.
Yep,
and by all accounts, it was a very nice place. But anytime you have basically a tribal society, that keeping the balance is very hard. And by tribal, you'd mentioned it.
Well, and the way they did it, right? Remember the Green Line? I mean, we have Christians on one side and we have Arabs on the other, right? And so, not Arabs, but we have people of the Islamic faith over here. And they essentially had their own version of Jim Crow based on religion in Beirut. And that's how they kept the peace. And then it got uneasy. But no, I have friends that are Lebanese who, you know, the father, who's since passed away, but he was, he would go to San Diego, and he would say, San Diego reminds me of Beirut.
Oh, interesting. No. Yeah, well, I've never been.
I said, oh, really? Does Beirut have strip bars like Pacers and other assorted ones?
in the Christian part.
That's what he said. Of course it. He said. He said, "Of course it is. It's a resort area." I said, "Oh, all right." All right. So, a mutual friend of Grant and mine started chirping over the weekend, and lo and behold, I have to find out in the streets that the Center for Security Policy put out a press release. Grant Newsham joins the center as a senior fellow. So, first of all, congratulations. That obviously must be a good thing, yes?
I think so. It was always nice to be asked, and you know, it's a platform. It's a good opportunity to share a few ideas.
Would you care to comment on how instrumental All Marine Radio was and this position being offered to you? Do you think it played no part? Do you think it played an extremely critical part or somewhere in between? What would you say?
Well, I'll be slipping you 20 in your front pocket the next time we meet, like Sinatra-esque, sort of oiling my way into a bit of a Vegas nightclub. It doesn't hurt.
If you Google, and I'm using Google as a verb right there, although it is a noun, but popular usage has created a verb out of the company's name. So anyway, if you Google Grant's name, I mean, All Marine Radio is like all over it. Who is this guy, man? He must own All Marine Radio, or at least McNamara must owe him money. So, in fact, I had a conversation about you over the weekend.
Oh, no. And
somebody brought your name up to me as saying that I think that the one thing that I've learned the most listening to your program, other than, you know, living with trauma and the whole post-traumatic winning thing I do, is about the Pacific Rim. He said, I can't tell you how much I enjoy listening to Grant Newsham. And I said, I probably have learned more about the Pacific Rim than any other part of the world relative, and Grant's been at the center of that. So you are a crowd favorite, and I commend the Center for Security Policy for hiring you. I hope they're paying you a lot of money.
Well, by my standards, anything is a lot. So
you'll be buying another villa. So you have a villa in Hawaii, another villa in Taiwan, and now you'll be heading back to your homeland. They're based in D.C., yes?
That's where they are, but I don't have to go anywhere.
Oh, but you can go for the annual meeting and put your Washington Nationals hat on and wear your Washington Football Club sweatshirt on. Because Grant is from the Old Dominion, for those of you who don't know, with all that entails. So you won't be summoned back to headquarters anytime soon?
Oh, no, I don't think so. No. It's an affiliation, and it's an opportunity to sort of get the things I write, the ideas I have, to get them out in a different forum. And
So how does that work? How does that work? Does your work, will some of your work appear there exclusively, or how does that work?
You could see some of that. It'd be a little different format than some of the articles, but it could be, say, a briefing paper or sort of a special sort of focused comment on something. Could appear exclusively with CSP, and what I write will also appear on their sort of their channels as well.
Got it. All right. Anything else that I haven't asked you that you want to tell everybody, all your faithful audience, so they don't have to find out in the street like I had to find out about this?
No, I generally have to be asked something before I volunteer.
You're not leaking information.
Not that I have anything, but yes.
Here's an email. Yeah. Mac, ask Grant about TikTok and data mining by the People's Liberation Armies. Grant, when you connect the dots through TikTok, and a third of the American population has downloaded that application. What does that mean?
You know, it gives you access, potential access to a lot of information about people in particular. And, you know, keep in mind that I, until not all that long ago, thought that when a DVD was finished, you turned it over to listen to the other side. The way I look at these kind of electronic things is to turn it on its head and think what we could do if we had something like TikTok in China. That you have the potential to suck up all sorts of information about people, about things, about strategy, etc. And it gives you access into something, like having access into a bank or to a house. It lets you get in and take stuff. And that is where the vulnerability is. And if you don't really need a criminal mind, but you do need a conspiratorial mind. Well, it helps to have a criminal mind to think of ways to capitalize on this. And that's what it gives us. I think it's loosely comparable, is when the Chinese hacked and stole apparently the entire Office of Personnel Management, U.S. Office of Personnel Management database during the Obama administration. That, think about it, you know, if you've ever applied for a government job or worked for the government, you filled out a lengthy application with all sorts of stuff on it, and China has it. That's obviously not a good thing. You think a U.S. administration would have at least complained a little bit. And this is what TikTok does. It's a variation on that, as I see it. It gives the Chinese potential access to a lot of information. And the challenge is to be able to capitalize on that and to be able to sort of summon up exactly what you want. But that's really just a technical question. It's not like the old East German Stasi secret police that had like files on every human in East Germany. It had so many of it, but it was in hard copy, and they didn't quite know what to do with it or couldn't handle it. But with the technology, it does give the Chinese a potential sort of entry into a lot of good, sort of detailed, very detailed information about Americans and things America's doing. What if you had, say, the Secretary of State's administrative assistant was on TikTok? Or you could just have to narrow it down a bit, and suddenly you've got very nice access into targets that you would want. So I always turn it on its head and think of how we could capitalize on it if we had something similar.
Is your assessment, is that theoretical? I mean, is this something that we're really not sure if the Chinese are doing this or not, but, or do you think if you don't believe the Chinese intelligence apparatus is using this as a manner to either get information or compromise people, then I've got an explosion in Beirut that I want you to help me investigate?
Oh, it's definitely the latter. You have to assume that they are, making full use of it as necessary. You look at how thoroughgoing the Chinese espionage effort is worldwide, and you really are impressed with it. The scale, the scope, and the willingness to use anything to get in from anything and anyone to get information. I think we've talked about it before, but the inroads they've made into, say, U.S. academia and in sensitive areas that, to hire away and, pay U.S. professors, Chinese professors in the United States, etc., that it's almost everybody's a target, potential target for them, and they have the resources to go and the brazenness to go after it. So this is just an electronic version of a number of things they're doing, but an electronic version of sort of human spying potentially. And certainly we understand that. You know, if we don't, then God help us. But this is pretty easy to figure out what they potentially could do. And it's not, it isn't the Trump administration has taken on itself to simply harass a successful Chinese company so Bill Gates and Microsoft can benefit from it. But there is the security aspect of this has to be taken very seriously and also weighed in. Put in the context of all these other things that China has going, very much a full court press.
Do you see, this is a little bit of a change, but do you see the irony in Walmart being the vehicle that transfers a lot of American retail activity into China?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. It's, I'm sure you remember it very well. But remember when Walmart first came about in the early 80s, really, this thing called Walmart. There's this guy named Sam Walton from Bentonville, Arkansas, I think.
Yep.
And their entire pitch, their whole thing, all their advertising, etc., was made in America. American made. And that has now gone to nothing made in America, all made in China. And it has put, it has... It has played a major role, not the only role, but it has certainly had a big part in shifting American manufacturing overseas. And when I talk about manufacturing, I'm not talking about cars, but rather these little things that, the companies that used to make like spatulas or socks, etc. These very household things that used to be made in little factories that people worked in and had could have a decent life. It all disappeared, and once Walmart started, jumped into China, started sourcing things there that just helped hollow out U.S. industry, and they seem to have no concern about it at all. What they've done. The irony, as you pointed out, is astonishing. And I can remember this must have been, 20 years ago at least, at Marfor Pack in Hawaii. There was a Marine Reserve major there, and he was on some active duty, and he was working for Walmart. And I remember him giving me the pitch that, because I'd made some comment about, what they were doing to savage the United States of America. And he gave me the pitch was, we save the average, family like $700 a year because they can buy cheap crap at Walmart. And I was, even Newsom could figure out that, okay, if you save 700 bucks a year, but you're the father or the mother has lost their job and is now on welfare. Well, that, $700 isn't much for, and if it's somebody who's, really has no more opportunity, boy, thanks a lot, Sam Walton. Or it's, and he, I think, does, he was alive long enough to see that, to have this happen, be around when this happened. So unfortunately, he deserves some credit for that, and it's, you get the scale and the scope going, as they say, the scale of their business, and it does have a, it really has a huge effect on the U.S. in particular.
Yeah, it's,
I hot dogs that they serve at Walmart. but that said, I just wish it would disappear.
Right. I mean, you
for
see
all the harm it's done.
Yeah, you see, it started out. Alan Jackson wrote a song called "Little Man," right? Right. The court squares abandoned. All the stores are board, are closed, and it transformed. I mean, it gutted. Now those same malls are being gutted by Amazon and COVID. And over the weekend, Amazon was in the news saying that we may we're in negotiations with mall owners to place all our fulfillment centers Now, I don't rightly know what a fulfillment center is, but I think I should go to one. I mean, don't I want to be fulfilled? I mean, or is it just another store? Because I don't need to go to a store, but a fulfillment center is something that I probably would want to go to.
I don't know. I head up to Ojai for the weekend when I need to get fulfilled in guru's sweat lodge.
Ojai, you go to the sweat lodge in the hemp center up there?
Well, just only when I'm in SoCal, when I'm in Southern California. You know.
But it's amazing the transformation that has started with Walmart in the destruction of American retail. And really, that was in tandem, right? That's the storefront. And then underneath that is contributing to the destruction of American manufacturing, right? By this, but he's a conservative guy and he contributes to the Republican Party. And the Republican Party, the party of Orrin Hatch, when Donald Trump was saying, hey, look, this China thing is nonsense. And Orrin Hatch says, hey, you know, these tariffs, I'm really concerned. I'm a free trader.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So do you not understand what's going on, Orrin? Do you not understand that nothing that China does is free?
I think a fulfillment center, because I've heard the word, and it's like one of these, it's like from a cartoon like The Simpsons, or one of these cynical cartoons where they call it a fulfillment center, and you look into it, and it's like these, you have a bunch of these sort of slave zombie types who are, you know, on these, putting things into boxes on a... a conveyor belt, and well, somebody's whipping them. It reminds you of like the old post office had that reputation, but worse. And you hear the fulfillment center; it just reeks of that,
doesn't it?
The new age business, human resources, sort of propaganda. Propaganda is actually a good.
Yeah, word, no, it is right that we're going to have a fulfillment center. But if you walk into it, you know what it's going to remind you an awful lot of.
Like a prison, or with people with whips, is what I imagine. And you know, I don't wish.
It's going to remind you an awful lot of Walmart. That's what it's going to remind you of. This aisles and aisles of fulfillment. I mean, products.
Yeah, I didn't know that it was actually going to be like a store.
News over the weekend. So Amazon will continue its dominance of the world, and now it's coming. Full circle. You know, Amazon has made, you know, this incredible, you know, fortune that rivals, you know, names like Carnegie and Rockefeller and things like that. And now they're coming back to your community, to your mall, to save the day. So you will have a mall. Don't worry about that. But it is amazing the metamorphosis of American retail, American manufacturing, the role that China has played in all of this, the role the government has played in not contesting in that domain and allowing all that manufacturing business to go out of the country and under the guise of globalization and free markets. Which brings me to another question. I had a conversation with somebody who we were talking about domains that the United States does not contest in, right? Social media is one of them. That you have other intelligence apparatuses around the world that have a field day in the United States using social media, blah, 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 blah. And we've been slow on the uptake relative to contesting that. Also, we've also been slow on the uptake in the economic realm, where China uses it as an element of warfare against the United States, and you've made a smart about the penetration into the university system, the way they can control what you see on your television, right? And it used to be just a different version was made for China. Now it's a different version made for the whole world. And so I'm curious your thoughts on that, Grant, about domains that we don't contest in. Are we starting to be smart about that or no? Are we still, you know, heckle and Jekyll or in terms of we don't really see it yet, and even though it's going on every day?
You know, it's hard to, you know, it's often hard to, I don't know, get enough distance or enough vision the breadth of vision to really have a real sense of the scale, you know, of that particular sort of thing. And it's also, you know, one's always leery to sort of write off the United States on things. But, you know, once again, when you look at what, you know, how it has changed in the last 35 years or so, that, you know, in terms of the way people went about making a living and how they could live their lives in the United States, it's really, you know, something's happened. And not for the better. To just go to Youngstown, Ohio, or Akron and spend a week there living in a Red Roof Inn and see if I'm wrong. I'd suggest that anyone who says there's no problem has no idea how those sorts of places and those sorts of people have suffered. One thing that I would note is you see it in international business a lot, is that there used to be something called a Yankee trader. And what that meant was you could go anywhere on the planet and there would be some American guy selling stuff. And I mean, just anywhere. And those people, it seems that as if that is an extinct species. And nowadays you go anywhere on the planet and you probably will not find Americans selling stuff. But what you will find is Chinese people selling things. You know, it's that pioneer, that adventure spirit to go out and do something to make money anywhere, you know, anywhere on earth. It doesn't mean you'll be liked over time, or a really short time, in fact. But you go anywhere and you will find Chinese business people. And I'm thinking of Africa, Latin America, Middle East, Central Asia, you name it. South, you know, the Pacific Islands, and you find Chinese business people there. And that is an area where I think we're just not present. We're not even in the ballpark. You know, it's like one team has shown up to play baseball, and they've even brought an extra team with them so they can have a game if you Americans don't show up. And that is something you notice. You know, I had a friend who was in Ethiopia. This was maybe, I don't know, 10 years ago. And he had a conversation very much like this with an Ethiopian fellow. And the guy said, "Where are you Americans? You know, you're just not here." And there's something, you know, we don't, at least in this area, we don't have this drive to sort of get out and do things. I think there'll be all sorts of arguments. Well, it's the return on investment isn't this or that, or it's not, you know, it'll hurt our shareholder equity, et cetera. To staff a fully loaded employee out there would cost us so much. There's all sorts of excuses not to do it. But if the Yankee trader were to come back, I think that would be a good thing. And there's probably things that a competent government could do to help promote this. And that's not a cheap shot, but it applies to a lot of every administration. So that's one area where I think we have, you know, in terms of we're just missing in action. But you really do feel it if you get around the world. There's even a story that gives you a sense of this, is that, you know, if you go to Africa, you'll see Chinese people doing all sorts of things to make money. And there was one, so it was like a guy from West Africa. This wasn't all that long ago, and he was complaining about this, and he said, the Chinese are even selling plantains. And I may have mentioned this on the show before. But his point was that selling plantains, fried bananas, on the street is the entry level into the economic ladder in these societies. And it allows a person to do something that generates some income. But it's the bottom rungs. And here you have Chinese people who are doing that over in Africa. And that was... there's two ways to look at it. One is that it is displacing local people who have no other options. But at the same time, it was a willingness on the part of, in this case, the Chinese, to actually get out and do what's considered a very modest job, but to make some money. And, you know, with us, you know, it seems so much of our perspective is almost from a Wall Street financial perspective in terms of whether or not something is worth doing. But you know, just to say, just an observation. But the social media, part of it, I really don't know enough about it to say. I think we'd probably be good at thinking new ideas and getting the basic ideas, and then outsourcing all the work to somebody cheap. So you'll have Jeff Bezos, or you know, one of these Silicon Valley guys. You know, very few number of people in America actually would benefit from these things. I'm just sort of throwing that out as an observation that. It seems to be how things work today. You know, you mentioned Andrew Carnegie and Rockefeller, that yes, these guys got rich as Croesus, but they also did give a lot of other people in the United States the opportunity to make a living, a decent enough living. I don't want to overstate, but it certainly was enough to give the next generation the opportunity to make an even better living. And now, you know, you don't see it. What's left is $12 an hour at Walmart, and you know, try having 6 children on that, and it's something's been disrupted, obviously.
Here's an email, Mac. I'm curious, Grant's thoughts about the growing public feud between China and the United States. So I think over the weekend, China announced sanctions on, I don't know what impact that has, but China sanctioned Marco Rubio. I don't know if they closed down his TikTok account. But China, in very publicly, you know, pushing back on United States, United States actions for any number of reasons, from coronavirus to Hong Kong to, you know, what they do in the South China Sea, whatever. So the fact that this has entered kind of a new phase, which is a very public phase, what do you make of that?
This is definitely getting contentious, and I think it's almost reminds you of back in the late 90s when the Americans accidentally shot that missile into the Chinese spy center in Yugoslav. Where was it? Zagreb, the other, the Yugoslav capital.
Belgrade?
Yeah, that the Chinese were really angry. And this kind of reminds you of back then. But the correlation of forces, I think, is different, where China has a lot more military strength, economic power, to make life difficult for people. And I think the relationship it's as nasty as I can remember it. But this is what comes of, if you decide to take on the bully, you know, when he is 12 years old, it's going to be a lot easier than when he's 21 and, you know, and ripped. This is kind of where we are, but this is a nasty relate. The relationship has become, it's taken on a tone that I would not dismiss the potential volatility of it. I think what the Chinese are counting on is a change of administration and a return to sort of more nuanced American policymakers. I use that word cynically, of course. But I think that is what they're counting on. I noticed just the other day somewhere that two of candidate Biden's sort of China advisors and guys who are probably in line to get positions involving China and Asia in his, if he were to win an election, they just had a sit down with the former chairman of Goldman Sachs, Henry Paulson, who's also Secretary of Treasury when the 2008 financial collapse hit. And he's considered a real China expert. But my goodness, he is just really typifies the greed and the stupidity that got us, that really sold out American interests for Chinese cash. And he knows about as much about China as some guy who from China who comes to America, gets in a limousine at Dulles, drives to the Hay Adams across from the White House, goes to some nice parties with the elite in Georgetown, and then goes back to China. That's how much he knows about how much Paulson knows about China. Not much at all, but they know enough to have made themselves fabulously wealthy. So here you have a couple guys who are potentially going to be big hitters in a Biden administration, and you know that what they're all going to do is they're going to go back to the accommodate China, do not challenge China, don't make China unhappy. They're going to sort of way of behavior, and they're going to everything they do is going to be prefaced with the question, what will China think? And that, I think, is where the Chinese are counting on the United States to return to. But for now, this administration, it has gotten, you know, China irked by simply standing up to it and on a number of fronts. And you'll notice that even some other countries and around the world are standing up as well. Even the EU has just shown some tentative signs of complaining a bit. And even in ASEAN, the Southeast Asian nations have actually, Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam have actually done a few things legally in regards to the South China Sea that have surprised people because they have, in fact, challenged China in ways that people didn't think they would. So the relationship now is, it does remind me of Belgrade incident, but in some ways worse, because China can actually try to make life difficult for us, or more difficult for us and for our friends. And they're on the move. I don't know. So we'll see. We think we'll know in November what direction all this is going to take.
Here's another email. Mac, I find it interesting that there isn't more discussion about the COVID-19 virus being done deliberately by the Chinese. Does Grant have an opinion on that?
My guess is that there was the early stages, and for a considerable time afterwards, there was a definite effort to track this back to the Chinese Communist Party, and to make sure that this was prominent in the discussion, and whenever anyone talked about it, to mention this. But you're right, you don't hear that much anymore. Right. And I think that has to do with with Trump derangement syndrome, where the mainstream media and the commentariat, they refuse to mention it because it's something that would help President Trump. If Trump has done something, the opposite must be bad, and the opposite must be good. But I think it is a concerted effort by the people who would mention this in places that the public might hear it, a concerted effort to refuse to talk about the connection between the coronavirus and the People's Republic of China. It does get a little attention, of course, but not anything near what it deserves. And it's almost like this thing that has done all the harm it's done, has killed hundreds of thousands of people, that there's a conspiracy, a tacit agreement on the part of people, who should be mentioning, not to mention it. And I think that observation is, in fact, correct. And my guess is the administration has decided that by mentioning it, by keeping it front and center in people's consciousness, that all that provokes so much sort of venom from the administration's enemies that it's maybe not worth the effort. But it's unfortunate if this is allowed to be forgotten, because whether or not it was deliberately set loose on us, one can obviously debate that. But the fact that it came out of China is enough, and there's enough certainly evidence that of really Chinese Communist Party complicity in setting this loose on the civilized world.
Yeah, again, do you believe in coincidences? Another email. Mac, I saw Grant quoted in this article. The article is entitled, China's 100-day push near Senkaku Islands comes at unsettling time for Sino-Japanese. Is it Sino or Sino?
Sino.
Sino-Japanese ties. If you scroll down a ways, let's see. Where do I find Newsom? Oh, the Japanese Self-Defense Force is gradually being overworked and overwhelmed, said Grant Newsom. Yes, it can go out and respond to Chinese air and sea incursions, but the Chinese are showing up in more numbers, in more places, and more often than ever, and the SDF simply doesn't have the resources to match the Chinese. Play this out for a few more years, and the mismatch will widen. Fairly pessimistic view, my friend. Is that simply just the way it is, and we all better come to grips with it as the Chinese expand their operations, expand the frequency, and the density of what's going on near the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea?
Well, you certainly got a trend, and if it plays out, say, even 5-10 years, that's what is going to happen. One can almost do the math. I even heard the Japanese explain to me, this was, goodness, 8 years ago, they had done the math and really on the year at which, if shipbuilding and trends in particular continued, that it was the year at which the Chinese would have them. And that year passed, actually, a couple of years ago. And that is, you know, what you're going to see. It reminds you of, say, one of these movies that appeals to people like me, or teenage, like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, where you have a principal in a hallway, and he's trying to get the students under control. They're just swarming by him and ignoring him. And that's kind of what you're going to have, is the just so many Chinese ships and aircraft out there so often that China, if Japan, even if they sort of go on a push and send out everything they've got, they're still going to be a lot more of the other guys. And if the other guys ignore you, what do you do? If you shoot, well, they're all going to shoot you. And you just simply get in a position where you can't respond at any reasonable cost. And that is where things are headed, unless the U.S. and the Japanese really get their act together and fast and make this defense of the East China Sea into a sort of a joint defense where you combine your resources. And I don't see the evidence that that's happening, at least not on the scale or the way that it needs to. And so if you don't do that, then individually, I think we're all going to be swarmed out in the East China Sea, and the South China Sea we kind of already are, but you know, it's so you got to think of something different. And if it's, you know, if the Chinese are able to build ships so much faster and greater numbers than us, and you know, look at their shipbuilding capability and look at ours, and it's, my goodness, it embarrasses you. It's embarrassing. It's almost as if Henry Kaiser came back to life and sort of set up shop in China. And he's the guy who built the Liberty ships in World War II. You know, they're cranking out like one a day practically. But if you look at that and you think, well, how are we going to match the Chinese? That, you know, hopefully we have some smart guys, you know, who are figuring out a way that we can like sink their ships so fast that it doesn't matter how many they make. You know, maybe the solution isn't to try to match them one for one, but you know, until you've got that magic weapon or that magic solution, you'd better sort of wake up and pretty fast. And you know, this, you know, mentioned it somewhere that, you know, we just cranked out the USS Tripoli finally came online, this new amphib, and yet in the last, and then we had the Bonhomme Richard burn up. Unfortunately, a few weeks ago in San Diego, or in the Beirut of Southern California. And, well, the Chinese in from late 2019 to early 2020, they launched two Type 075 amphibious ships, which is like a WASP class.
Right.
Amphib. They've got another one on the way.
Their version of the big decks.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So they've put out three of these, and they apparently it took 6 months from the time they laid the keel to got it in the water.
Whoa.
Now we produce the Tripoli, however many years it took, and whatever couple billion dollars. So they put out three. I've got three coming. We've got just managed to get one, and then we've had another one burn up. And so you can see that they're building them a lot faster than we are. And it's also important to remember that China doesn't really have a defense budget. It has whatever money they need. And I think they have actually created this. They've actually stated a defense budget only to kind of keep us happy. But they see defense spending as spending for the national interest, and they see social spending as spending for the national interest. And there's not really a distinction between the two. So they have any amount of money practically to build things. And that is a troubling sort of situation. And the way out of it, as I see it, is it'd be nice if we could build ships for less than all the money in the world and taking a really long time to do it. And if we could get our act together on that line, that would be a good thing. But also, I do think if we could, you're going to have to come up with some sort of weapon that leapfrogs our traditional thinking and that can crack an enemy ship in half just with one shot, and at a pretty low cost. You've got to come up with something addresses the mismatch that's headed our way.
Here's another email. Max, you guys had a pretty interesting roundtable last Thursday. I'd be curious about Grant's thoughts relative to Secretary of Defense Esper withholding the Navy shipbuilding plan from the White House because he didn't believe it provided a, quote, credible path forward. The financial implications of that are huge, as you all rightly pointed out, and it certainly come at a time when the United States Marine Corps is looking for more money and more ships. Grant's thoughts on that. I don't know if you saw that story, Grant, but it's pretty interesting, pretty ominous for the Marine Corps. Secretary Esper saying that. And it was for the confirmation of the guy being nominated for CAPE, right, which is the, essentially financial analysis over the DOD plans. And, when asked, he said, yeah, the SecDef withheld that because he does not believe the Navy's path forward is credible. And said that in public, for God's sakes. Any thought? You're a smart guy. Any thoughts, the implications of that when you're talking about, Ford class aircraft carriers, when you're talking about, nuclear, the boomer class of submarine, those are big ticket items and tend to suck all the oxygen out of the room.
I'm not really informed enough to, comment, about the specifics of shipbuilding plans or this and that, but certainly you can see we've really got a problem and we've had it for a long time. What I do know of our shipbuilding performance over, the last 15, 20 years, and the problems we've had, think of the Zumwalt destroyer, of which, billions of dollars, and they finally canceled it after three, and the weapons system doesn't work. And it seems to be leprechauns are to blame for it because no human is responsible for it. But think if our adversary, say China, had the same, what we know of our shipbuilding capabilities and plans, suppose China was having to deal with what we're dealing with, we would be delighted to have them in that kind of a mess. And that's so. This writ, to my way of thinking, really is serious. You know, they, you know, numbers do matter, and it isn't just, you know, having these super capabilities, but rather you've got to have enough numbers to be in enough places to sort of assert yourself. And we are not producing enough ships to be around the world doing things. And the Chinese are on a track to be able to do this. So is there some reason why the Chinese can't be like we were 30, 40 years ago in terms of naval presence and power? And I'd say no. And so with this, you know, with the state of our shipbuilding sort of effort, I don't know what to say other than, you know, I would call back probably the last five CNOs and as many secretaries of navies, and I would cashier them. Do whatever it is you do to the civilian secretaries. I don't know if you cashier them, but this is not leprechauns that have allowed this situation to develop, and you can't blame it on Capitol Hill. This is something where the Navy has just a self-inflicted sort of injury that, you know, you hardly know what to say. But it just, the incompetence just seems breathtaking. And I don't know of a nice way to put it, but once again, it's not leprechauns who did it. And yet, you know, the CNOs, they all, you know, which one of them, who's responsible for this? Apparently nobody. So I don't, you know, I'm pretty glum when it comes to this particular issue, that if any country on earth should be able to build ships and, you know, that its Navy needs, you'd think it was, it'd be us, but you know, I don't know what it is.
Can't do it. We cost them out, consistently cost overruns. Means we under-deliver in terms of the number of platforms. We were going to order six, but we ultimately bought three because of cost overruns. And if you keep doing that, I mean, it's no way to do anything. More breaking news. Lebanon's prime minister has resigned after the cabinet resigned en masse. So Lebanon's instability will continue. And so I guess I shouldn't be surprised over that. All right, Grant, what do you what's next for you to write, and where will we see it? Which one of your channels should we tune into?
Oh, I'm not sure which yet. I'm sort of working it up. I'm going to try to write something. It's not necessarily contrarian, but it's sort of in the even Newsham can figure stuff out category. That, you know, I'm sort of coming to the conclusion when I think about the situation down in Japan's southern islands involving the Senkakus and the East China Sea, that, you know, because I've been recommending for years that the Japanese, you know, have a joint defense down there and that they link up with us and that they do this and do that. And I'm coming to the conclusion that Japan is actually not, I think they have no interest actually in fighting to defend those islands. They're sort of going through the motions. I think they would like it if the Chinese went away, but I don't think they're going to shoot.
So the Japanese, but what about their economic interest in the region? I mean, so will they just say, okay, well, I guess you guys are going to have to go someplace else and fish because we're not willing to defend it. And the Chinese slowly but surely be like the Kraken in Pirates of the Caribbean, slowly but surely, you know, get its arms around us and then snap us in two. So probably a good idea to go someplace else because we're not going to contest this?
Maybe. You know, it's the argument is going to be, well, it's not, we know it, we don't like it, but it's, there's nothing we can do and it's not worth a war. And you're going to have the Japan Inc., the Japanese business class is going to go along with that. There's parts of the ruling class that will. There will be Japanese and, you know, in the political world, the military in particular, and the public, which would not like this. So that's why that ruling class that decides these things can't say this publicly, what I've just said. But I just have this feeling that they're willing to let it go. And you'd think, well, how could that be? And then you ask yourself, well, how did the Obama administration let the Chinese have the South China Sea? You know, there were plenty of us howling that it shouldn't do it, plenty that didn't like it, and yet it happened. And it's just a feeling. So I'm sort of writing it to make myself popular.
Well, what do you mean? How could it be just a feeling? I mean, I think it's a statement of the obvious, eh?
Well, I want to at least raise it that, you know, and you know, there's some things even I can figure out eventually. And maybe I should have figured this out years ago, but it could be that they just don't, you know, they're not, at the end of the day, they're not going to, you know, to shoot. And when you're up against an enemy or an adversary that is willing to shoot, well, who do you think is going to win? And that is something that I think does need considered, and I'm not sure that it has gotten the consideration it deserves on the U.S. side or even on the Japanese side. In fact, in Japan, a lot of things just go on. In fact, everything goes unspoken. So that's not surprising, but I think the Americans, it's always, you know, the idea has always been, well, our stout Japanese allies, we're in this together.
Yes,
we're,
of course,
marching arm in arm, we're going to defend Japan. But, you know, you think, well, maybe not. You know, maybe the other guy isn't quite as interested in shooting as we are. So that's what I'm sort of thinking about at the moment.
Well, what is the reason why Japan doesn't, you know, in a big way, say, you know, we are very interested in forming some form of defense partnership with the United States in the region and working in concert with the United States Navy to make sure that this rules-based order that's served the world so well since World War II is not usurped by this Chinese aggression. It's not like they would have to build more ships or anything like that. They simply have to make the overture to the United States and say, we're interested in doing that. Why haven't they? Why wouldn't they do that? Or have they?
Oh, goodness. I do think they need to build more ships and they need to get more people in their Navy.
Do this as a first step and then go from there.
It's, oh, yeah.
Right?
No,
I mean, why wouldn't they do it?
That's right. You know, it's this reticence.
And if we were lying about building ships and we weren't really going to do that, I mean, surely we could trick the Americans into coming and helping us.
Right? Well, they've been doing that very well for 70 years.
Right.
They have, you know, I think part of it is this pathologic dependence on the United States, where you just get so used to the Americans doing all the work. And it, for a long time, it never really seemed like you had anything to worry about. You know, the Chinese weren't that much of a threat, it could be argued, until fairly recently. But this, and there was, you know, there is some reluctance to do too much militarily based on having gotten the bejesus knocked out of them in World War II. But really, it's just laziness. You know, it's sort of, if you got this big, dumb, rich uncle who's taking care of everything for you, why exert yourself? And I think that this is a big aspect of that in the reason why they haven't really jumped at the idea of really being able to operate with us. And Americans have never pushed it. Right. And that has not helped. So we've sort of facilitated this pathologic dependence. And now it's always, you know, some things, the sooner you do them, the better it is. But we've kind of waited a while, and it's going to be a little harder to get things in order if we can.
Yeah.
So that's my sense of it.
Got it. All right, sir. First of all, congratulations on your new affiliation. Well done. I think it's, I mean, honestly, Grant, I mean, the people that listen to you. Oh, hold on. I've got one more. Mac, ask Grant if he thinks Trump has a good reading of the Chinese.
The short answer is yes. You know, he certainly, people around him do. And as we've mentioned before, that, you know, this administration has done more than every other one put together. I think he got a little off track in the beginning, where his instincts, and I'm just guessing, that he should have been harder on the Chinese than he was, and he let him off the mat a couple times when he went after, say, for example, that Chinese telecom company ZTE. Right. He should have put it out of business. Maybe he spent too much time in the pro wrestling business, but he didn't go for the jugular the way he should have early on. But keep in mind that he was also getting advice from and a lot of pressure from the Wall Street crowd to not go hard on the Chinese, to not upset this great racket that they had going. And I think that may have caused some trouble, because made it harder for the people in his administration who knew what needed done. It made it hard for them to get those policies in place. So I think it took a little while for Mr. Trump to realize that there was no deal that you could cut with the Chinese. So he's, I think, got a pretty good sense of it. And say compared, name somebody who had a better, name a president who did better at it. And I can't think of one. If this administration leaves in November, I'm not optimistic about what's coming.
Cautiously pessimistic, as he said.
Not even that. I would actually put
you've downgraded on. That.
It's even worse than that. Say game is over.
What's below cautiously pessimistic?
It used to be like moving to Nevada, but not anymore. I think Nevada's turned into something else. There's something. Let's say like really, really pessimistic. Hmm. That would do.
Yeah, that's not good. In any case, whatever the hell it is, it isn't good.
We'll see. Sometimes.
No, I mean, don't leave us with that hope, because I think until people aren't ready to confront the reality of what of what's going on the planet, then you're pretty much screwed. And for whatever reason, we continue to want to play the emperor's new clothes with the national interests of the nation, and it's pretty pathetic, in my opinion.
Okay, then I won't.
I love the cautiously pessimistic label. I think it's rich, because it's so funny. I just don't see it. Don't see it. And so,
I wouldn't even throw in cautiously, because I know enough about some of the people who are coming in a Biden administration, and also have the 40 years of empirical evidence of what that approach has gotten us. So it's, maybe the Chinese will surrender. Back to cautiously pessimistic.
Maybe they'll have a revolution. They'll have a revolution, and they'll unilaterally stand down and disarm.
Could happen.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Grant. First of all, congratulations again.
Thank you
for doing this today, and we will talk to you down the road. So be well.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Thanks a lot. You bet. Appreciate it.
You bet. That is our friend Grant Newsham, who on to bigger and better things in his life. So congratulations to Grant for that. So and well done. He's obviously a crowd favorite here on All Marine Radio. That will do it. If you're just tuning in, All Marine Radio is doing big stuff, post-traumatic winning. The movie going to play this week, going to debut this week in Hawaii. So I'm working on that. And so in addition to that, what am I doing? All Marine Radio, the book, making progress over the weekend. So excited about that. What else am I excited about? So in hour one, you'll hear a little bit about that. You'll also hear about, it's kind of this ironic thing. Walmart, right? Walmart's, you know, the percentage I saw sells 80% of the goods they buy there are from China, right? So we've transferred our manufacturing, our retail base, right, comes out of China, and we gutted American retail for it. How about that? So that. Also, talk a little bit about domains that we don't contest too much, and that is on social media. You know, we have other nations that essentially assault America's democracy for their own ends, and we're not so quick on the uptake. And then the other part is economically, the economic predatory practices of the Chinese. We're just kind of getting savvy to it. And again, what's crazy is Donald Trump is one of the few people that has called them out for it. And and you don't see that often either. And, you know, as Grant said, that these people that have, essentially sold American interests for their own profit, might come back with the Biden administration, and then we can get back to business as usual, being friends with the Chinese, no matter what the consequences are. Ugh, right? So, and in a newsflash, Grant's not even cautiously pessimistic anymore. He'd have to upgrade his outlook to be cautiously pessimistic. That's depressing. So, anywho. So you'll hear, we'll talk about some of that stuff in hour one. So anyway, have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow on a Monday. All Marine Radio, over. And don't be afraid to change somebody's life out. Because you can do that. That's the life you want to live. In the midst of all this nonsense, shut it off. Go live your life. Go do good things. It will be what it will be. You know, just for the record, this stuff has always gone on. You just get to watch it now. You don't want to watch it. Wait till those two girls we talked about last week, those two women, wait till they start something and then be all over it like a hobo on a ham sandwich. What are their names? Hold on, I'll give you their names. Ariana Picari is one, and Barry Weiss is the other. So look for their names. When they do something, right, don't be afraid to tune in on it. With that said, All Marine Radio is over and out.
Hello?